It's The Unbelievable Truth with your host, David Mitchell.
Hello and welcome to The Unbelievable Truth, the panel show about incredible truths and barely credible lies. I'm David Mitchell. Please welcome Ed Byrne, Lucy Porter, Ian Smith and Maisie Adam. The rules are as follows. Each panellist will present a short lecture that should be entirely false, save for five hidden truths which their opponent should try to identify. Points are scored by truths that go unnoticed, while other panellists can win points if they spot a truth or lose points if they mistake a lie for a truth. First up is Lucy Porter. Lucy's current stand-up tour is titled No Regrets, all about not regretting those annoying things you've agreed to do in a moment of weakness. Still, she's here now, so she might as well make the most of it. Lucy, your subject is pigeons, stout grey birds commonly found in towns and cities, which are sometimes kept for racing or carrying messages. Off you go, Lucy. Fingers on buzzers, the rest of you.
Throughout the world, pigeons have been especially prized for their musical abilities. In ancient Athens, a huge clay bowl full of cooing pigeons would be placed in the corner of a dinner party to provide ambient background music. And pigeons have been shown to possess the ability to discriminate between the music of Bach and Stravinsky.
Ian.
I think pigeons can maybe differentiate between music.
Between music?
But, between
the music of Bach and the music of Stravinsky?
Yes, I'd forgotten the names of the composers and I was trying to style it out.
Okay. Well, it was a long time ago, but yes, Bach and Stravinsky.
Yes.
You're absolutely right.
Oh, well done. Yeah. Yes.
This is in 1984, researchers trained pigeons to distinguish between musical excerpts of Bach and Stravinsky. The birds were taught to peck a left button for Bach and a right button for Stravinsky, receiving food rewards for correct choices.
The passenger pigeon is the most common breed of pigeon in the United States and is so called as the breed has learned the ability to use public transport. Regular avian travellers on the New York subway are issued with travel cards and permitted to ride for free as long as they appear to match the photo on their ID. The flock of pigeons who inhabit Victoria Station in London hold protected status and have become the subject of a local legend that should they ever leave the station, then the trains will miraculously start running on time. Pigeons can swim faster than a black marlin, and over a distance of roughly a mile, a racing pigeon is faster than a fax machine, provided that fax machine is not going downhill on a skateboard. So, are all pigeon character traits positive? Well, in tests, they've been shown to be prone to lying, alcoholism, and gambling.
Ian.
I think it would be fun if the pigeons were alcoholics.
You know, like when you watch Mary Poppins and she's sat with all the pigeons, do you think that's just like a big hen do? Well,
Poppins is an enabler. She's a dealer, Mary Poppins.
Well, tuppence bag. That's drug dealer slang.
Well, in tests, unfortunately, pigeons have not been shown to be prone to alcoholism. So, I don't know why they wouldn't be, but Ed.
As wild as it may seem, I'm going to go for maybe they like gambling.
They do like gambling. Yes.
God, I forgot how much I love this show.
A 2010 study found that, much like humans, pigeons love to gamble. Researchers at the University of Kentucky offered the pigeons a choice: pecking a light that delivered three food pellets every time, or pecking a light that gave a big win of 10 pellets just 20% of the time, which means fewer pellets overall. The pigeons consistently picked the riskier option, preferring an average payout of 2 pellets over a guaranteed 3. They also found that hungry pigeons gambled more than satisfied ones, even though they had more to lose.
Would you say they enjoy a little flutter?
I mean, I guess if they were gulls, they'd use chips.
I mean, this is why we're here.
We always underestimate the important role pigeons have played in news and communication. The news agency Reuters started as a flock of pigeons ferrying financial news between Germany and Belgium, and the very first issue of the Soviet newspaper Pravda was delivered to Comrade Stalin by a pigeon, which he later had exiled to Siberia because he overheard it plotting a coup. Researchers at Oxford University were surprised to find that homing pigeons frequently ignored their inbuilt compass, choosing instead to follow motorways, circling round city ring roads and even turning right and left at main junctions, often adding miles to their journey. They then realised that they were just male pigeons who were simply too embarrassed to ask for directions.
Ed.
I believe that pigeons might follow roadways.
You're absolutely right, yes.
Yes.
Experts at the University of Oxford spent 10 years studying how homing pigeons navigate, only to find that they simply follow roads. Thank you, Lucy. So, Lucy, at the end of that round, you've managed to smuggle two truths past the rest of the panel, which are that over a distance of roughly a mile, a racing pigeon is faster than a fax machine. In 1990, this was put to the test by a Florida radio station using a dozen racing pigeons who successfully outpaced the fax machine over a distance of 2 miles, completing the journey in just over a minute and a half, while the fax machine was only halfway through sending the first page. And the second truth is that the news agency Reuters started as a flock of pigeons ferrying financial news between Germany and Belgium. And that means, Lucy, you've scored 2 points. The famous electrical engineer Nikola Tesla once fell in love with a female pigeon who he claimed he loved, quote, as a man loves a woman. Astonishingly, that is still not the craziest sentence involving a man and the word Tesla. Okay, we turn now to Ed Byrne. As an impecunious student in the early 90s, Ed studied horticulture at the University of Strathclyde. During his course, he gradually developed green fingers, a combination of malnutrition and alcohol poisoning. Ed, your subject is smoking, the action of inhaling and exhaling tobacco smoke by sucking on the end of a lit cigarette, cigar or pipe. Off you go, Ed.
The concept of smoking, as we know it, was inspired by the act of food smoking, or cloud cooking, as it was known until the 17th century. It was thought that if smoking could preserve meat, then it would also preserve living flesh, and so the act of smoking, or drinking smoke, as it was known until the 17th century, was born. In Ireland, which was the first European country where tobacco smoking was introduced, tobacco was used as currency so widely and so interchangeably with sterling, it was deemed legal tender until 1862.
Ian.
Were cigarettes legal tender?
In Ireland?
Yeah.
No.
I just snuck that one in to see if I could root out the racists on the panel. The term smoke and mirrors first came from the inordinate amount of time people used to spend staring at their own reflection, admiring how cool they looked with a cigarette.
Maisie.
We've all done it, haven't we? I think that's true.
It's not.
No?
No. No, that's not where smoke and mirrors comes from.
Kidding.
No.
The phrase pipe dream for an idea that would never come to fruition was born in the opium dens of China. Even the humble Pez sweet dispenser was designed to mimic the act of a cigarette lighter in the hopes it would encourage young children to grow up to be smokers.
Lucy.
Can I go for the pipe dream as an opium pipe dream?
You're absolutely right.
No.
Yes.
Edwina Curry is the only woman to achieve Pipe Smoker of the Year. She was rewarded by the presentation of a £2,000 Swiss briar pipe together with an annual supply of her favourite premium shag. Despite the obvious health benefits of smoking, the laws governing it have always been ludicrously draconian. The act of walking while simultaneously smoking a pipe, a pastime known as lunting, is banned in 10 different US states.
Lucy.
It's lunting. I like the idea there's a word for walking and smoking at the same time. Lunting.
I'm glad you like the idea because, yes, lunting is that word.
Oh. Yeah.
It's It was coined in the mid-16th century. The verb to lunt or lunting refers to the act of walking while smoking a pipe. So not a cigarette.
In Bhutan, relatives of people who have died from smoking-related diseases can pay to have their late family members' photographs printed onto cigarette packets along with the caption, "Come join me," in an attempt to curb people's appetites for the habit.
Ian.
I'm going to say that's true, but if not, I admire the dark humour of Ed to just invent that himself.
It is not true.
Oh! So, yeah. Ed.
In Trinity College Dublin, despite smoking being banned there since 1990, university ordinance stipulates that there should be a stock of tobacco and matches on hand during exams in case a student should need to calm their nerves. A similar rule exists on modern aircraft, where despite the smoking ban on all flights, airplane toilets must still be equipped with working ashtrays just in case.
I think the universities might be asking you to have matches and cigarettes on hand.
The Trinity College Dublin having tobacco matches on hand during exams.
No.
No, it's not true. No. And that's the end of Ed's lecture. And at the end of that round, Ed, you've managed to smuggle three truths past the rest of the panel, which are that the act of smoking was known as drinking smoke until the 17th century. The term came from the belief that inhaling smoke was similar to drinking a liquid. The second truth is that the Pez sweet dispensers were designed to mimic the act of a cigarette lighter. Early adverts even proclaimed, "No smoking, Pezzing allowed." Ironically, a product designed specifically to assist adults give up smoking was hugely popular with children and is thought by many to have encouraged generations of young people to take up smoking. And the third truth is that despite the smoking ban on all flights, aeroplane toilets must still be equipped with working ashtrays just in case. In 2009, a British Airways flight was delayed for 25 minutes as it didn't have an ashtray in the aeroplane bathroom. I think that's an American fact because I assume it also didn't have a bath. And that means, Ed, that you've scored 3 points. Next up is Maisie Adam. Maisie is one of the hosts of the podcast Big Kick Energy, all about women's football. And personally speaking, I love women's football just as much as I love the men's game. Not at all. Appropriately, Maisie, your subject is football, a sport played between two teams of 11 people where each team tries to win by kicking a ball into their opponent's goal. Off you go, Maisie.
The game of football got its name not because the ball was controlled by the feet, but because it was played on foot by the peasantry.
Ed.
That is how football goes down, because it's played on foot, not because it's played with your feet.
That's absolutely true, yes. But to you, it seems to me that to you that seems obvious.
I think I'd looked that one up.
You just literally knew it.
Well, because American football is also football and they carry it.
Yes, it got its name because it was played on foot. And this is in contrast to games like polo and jousting that were played on horses at the time. Being the past.
But can I applaud Maisie on opening her lecture with a fact? Like, that's a bold move.
I mean, if you really wanted to praise that, you could have not buzzed in. And then it would have worked. You're praising her for
First time on the show, but I didn't know we could revise.
Yes, contrary to popular belief, a popular belief Ed seems unaware of, the etymology of the word football does not come from the act of kicking a ball with a foot, but rather from the fact that the game was played on foot. But then actually, so cricket, that should be football as well. Hockey played on foot, football.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Netball.
Are you suggesting
netball,
maybe
football,
should
basketball.
We then change cricket to have cricket be played on horseback?
We're bloody
livening
it up a bit.
Why not?
That's not a bad idea.
I think the bowling would get quicker. But essentially, there are so many more kinds of football than I realise. I mean, I realise now that Wimbledon is actually a football tournament.
I'm kind of sorry I got this one right now.
Maisie.
When the English Football League was founded in 1863, it featured 27 clubs, with all the games played exclusively by women. These all-female teams never drew much of a crowd, as the wide crinolines and enormous bustles worn by the players made it impossible for spectators to see where the ball was. Since no men were involved, football was a very polite affair. A kick was known as a whoops, dribbling was called twinkling, to shoot was to gush, a header was a noddy, and a penalty was the kick of death. Then in the late 19th century, inspired by the costumes of pantomime principal boys, the ladies began to wear bright coloured tops and little shorts, which soon had men flocking to the games. At about this time, men began to form football teams of their own, and the FA was born. In 1921, seeing that the women were still drawing bigger crowds than the men, the FA banned women from playing the game, a ban that was to remain in force until 1957, when the FA's hand was forced by the indisputable talent of ladies such as Harriet Kane, Philippa Foden, and Kylie Walker.
Lucy.
They banned it in 19... Whatever it was banned.
You're absolutely right. Yes, in 1921, seeing that the women were still drawing bigger crowds than the men, the FA banned women from playing the game. And that ban was not in force until 1957. It was in force until 1971. Yes, before women's football was banned in 1921, it regularly attracted bigger crowds than many men's Premier League games today. Some matches drew over 50,000 spectators, nearly 10,000 more than the Chelsea men's team average today at Stamford Bridge. Despite its popularity, physicians began claiming football was unsuitable for women and could affect their chances of getting pregnant.
That's a thing, isn't it? Banning things for women by claiming that it affects pregnancy. Bicycle riding was frowned upon for similar reasons. They claimed it because they didn't like the liberation it gave women by riding bicycles.
So and the fact said that nuns enjoyed so it they so said much. It was
As the popularity of the men's game increased around the world, so did every player's demands, with cash-strapped clubs offering everything to keep their star players. Stoke City midfielder Dave Kelly was paid in Mintonware pottery. Minor league Matlock Town offered their main striker Colin Dawson the use of a sheepdog for a year. And Norwegian...
Ian.
I think the sheepdog.
Nope.
An absolute nightmare this episode.
I just love that when Radio 4 does get Northerners on, you get sound bites like that. I think the sheepdog.
Because to a Northerner, you think that's a good deal.
That's a good deal. and Norwegian Kenneth Christensen's transfer fee was his own weight in shrimp.
Ed.
I'm just going by the usually one of three facts. Or three statements is going to be true. We know that the sheepdog is a lie, so I'm going to go for the shrimp.
You're absolutely right. yes, when Norwegian footballer Kenneth Christensen signed for the third division team Flekkerøy, his former club, Vindbjart, requested a transfer payment of the player's body weight in shrimp. This all happened, by the way, in 2013.
Nowhere is the women's game more popular than in Iran, despite a complete ban on female spectators watching the Iranian women's team play. In 2018, one group of Iranian women supporters cleverly tried to get around a ban on attending matches by putting on false beards.
Ian.
I think the stuff about the Iranian women's football could be true, and this is purely going off... I know Maisie, and I don't know if she would opt to go into the dicey world of Middle Eastern politics. So I think that might be real.
So what part did you think was true?
And anything about Iran.
Because the Iranian fact is correct. In 2018, a group of Iranian women supporters cleverly tried to get around a ban on attending matches by putting on false beards. And that's the end of Maisie's lecture. At
the end of that round, Maisie, you've managed to smuggle one truth past the rest of the panel, which is that when football was first codified, a penalty was known as the kick of death. The rule also led to the introduction of the referee, as prior to this, on-field disputes were typically settled by team captains. And that means, Maisie, you've scored 1 point. It's now the turn of Ian Smith. Ian Smith is a successful comedian, podcaster, and actor, but his career only really started to take off when he adopted his current flashy stage name. Ian was a presenter on The Magic Sponge, a podcast which I'm guessing takes a hilarious sideways look at contraception. Your subject, Ian, is night, the period of darkness between sunset and sunrise. Off you go, Ian.
Nighttime was invented by God because daylight was annoying Adam and Eve and he hadn't quite figured out sunglasses. People who sleep on the left side of the bed are more likely to suffer with hay fever, while people who sleep on the right are more likely to join extremist political movements. Famous sleepwalkers include Alan Derwent, who mowed his lawn while asleep, Christine Holloway, who woke up to a finished yet inaccurate tax return, and Andras Molnar, who ate the entire contents of his fridge and was admitted to hospital.
Ed.
I'm going to say the first one about the guy who mowed his lawn while he was asleep was true.
It's not true.
Imagine if you woke up and found you'd mowed your lawn. I'd be delighted with myself.
Yeah. No, definitely. But what if you also found you'd killed?
As long as I think it might be the one where he raided his fridge. I've done that.
Yeah.
In my sleep, I've done it.
Have you?
Yeah. I had a whole packet of ham hock. In my sleep.
Ham hock?
Ham hock, yeah.
In a packet?
My mum had bought it for a buffet and she was absolutely livid.
Was she so livid you had to pretend you'd done it while you were asleep?
Well, Andras Molnar didn't do it.
Oh.
So, no.
The wealthy used their servants to their advantage at night. Before hot water bottles caught on, servants would be required to lie in bed in order to warm the sheets for their masters.
Maisie.
I reckon that's true.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, it's true that from the mid-17th century to the early 20th century, large houses often required parlour maids to lie in the bed in order to warm the sheets before the master and mistress retired for the night.
See, that again seems like somebody just sticking to a story.
Yeah.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
No, darling, she was just warming the bed.
Mooning, or the act of baring one's bottom, was performed by a French court jester in 1671, only for them to be beheaded by King Louis XIV. This is the origin of the phrase, the dark side of the moon. There have been an unusual number of unsuccessful products aimed at the night. In 1998, Sony halted shipment of a night vision camera when they discovered it could see through people's clothes. If you're lucky, you'll have had one of the few bowls of Night Flakes, Kellogg's short-lived cornflakes product aimed at divorced men who eat cereal in the evening. In a desperate attempt to drum up business, Horlicks even invented a fictitious condition called night starvation as part of their advertising campaigns. A drunk man who fell asleep in a bin and woke up in a landfill near Sheffield successfully sued for £60,000, as it was technically the wrong day for that specific bin to be collected.
Lucy.
Somebody sued the council because they weren't meant to be in a bin that was collected.
Yeah, it would be nice, wouldn't it? It's not true.
Oh.
Yeah, sorry.
Homeless Victorians could pay fourpence to sleep in an unused coffin, a trend that came back from the dead in 2016 due to the opening of the first vampire hotel in Whitby.
Maisie.
I think people might have slept in coffins just to keep warm.
You're absolutely right.
The only ones I've got right so far are about keeping warm in bed.
But it's true, the Fourpenny Coffin House was one of London's first homeless shelters, operated by the Salvation Army in the late 19th century. For four pennies, homeless clients could sleep in a coffin-shaped wooden box and receive food along with a tarpaulin to cover them while they slept.
Nighttime is the most dangerous time for animals. South African cows wear reflective earrings at night to make them visible to drivers. This has been criticised for distracting drivers, not due to distracting lights, but the shocking realisation of how attractive a cow can be when it puts in...
Surely not.
Lucy.
I think cows wear earrings in South Africa at night.
They do!
Yes!
After witnessing a fatal nighttime collision with a cow, Simon Morgan from KwaZulu-Natal University created a program called Reflector Cow, designed to make cows more visible to motorists at night.
In Wales, stray sheep at night are the biggest cause of road accidents, and farmers must count their sheep to make sure none have escaped. However, they find this nearly impossible to do without falling asleep.
Ed.
I believe that loose sheep is the greatest contributor to road accidents in Wales.
No.
I just put that one in to weed out the racists.
And that's the end of Ian's lecture. And at the end of that round, Ian, you've managed to smuggle two truths past the rest of the panel, which are that Sony halted shipment of a night vision camera when they discovered it could see through people's clothes, in the sense that the camera could detect the silhouette of a person's body underneath their clothing. Sony halted shipment of the cameras and modified the feature. And the second truth is that Horlicks invented a fictitious condition called night starvation as part of their advertising campaigns. The campaign claimed that this ailment, caused by a lack of essential vitamins, could be cured by drinking a cup of Horlicks before bedtime. In other news, Coca-Cola is not the real thing, Gillette is not the best a man can get, and when it comes to L'Oreal, you're really not worth it. And that means, Ian, you've scored 2 points. In the 18th century, night soil men had the unenviable task of gathering up all the human excrement and dumping it somewhere away from the centre of London. Hence the creation of South London. Which brings us to the final scores. In fourth place, with minus 2 points, we have Maisie Adam. In third place with no points, it's Ian Smith. In second place with 3 points, it's Ed Byrne. And in first place with an unassailable 5 points, it's this week's winner, Lucy Porter. That's about it for this week. Goodbye.
The Unbelievable Truth was devised by John Naismith and Graham Garden and featured David Mitchell in the chair with panellists Ian Smith, Lucy Porter, Ed Byrne and Maisie Adam. The chairman's script was written by Dan Gaster and Colin Swash and the producer was John Naismith. It was a random production for BBC Radio 4.